Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, as we pass another anniversary of 9/11, we'll revisit the other 9/11, the coup that destroyed Chile's democracy in 1973. Then, earlier in the week, the Obama administration vowed to destroy ISIS, invoking the long-held philosophy called just war theory. What exactly is just war theory, and can it be applied to modern warfare? On September 11, 1973, General Augustin Pinochet toppled democratically elected Salvador Allende, destroying the longest-standing democracy in Latin America. How much do we know now about what really happened in Chile and what was considered the other 9/11? With us are two experts. John Degas is a professor of journalism at Columbia University. He's the author of The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to Three Continents, and Our Man in Panama. Peter Kornbluh also joins us. He's the director of the National Security Archives Chile Documentation Project and of the Cuba Documentation Project. He's the author of The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability, and Back Channel to Cuba, the hidden history of negotiations between Washington and Havana. Welcome. Great to have you here. Let's start with a look back. Now, we're here in the anniversary of the week of the coup in Chile. John Degas, you were actually there living as a foreign correspondent at the time. How would you describe first pre-coup Chile and then what happened in the days preceding the coup?
The reason I went to Latin America was to be in Chile, and Chile was the story in Latin America, one of the biggest stories in the world, and what was going on was a revolution, and it was an incredibly unique an optimistic revolution because Salvador Allende was elected democratically with a minority of the votes in the popular election, but was then elected with a strong vote in the Congress. And he was attempting to introduce a revolution on the Marxist model, but using democracy. I like to describe it as circling the square. He tried to have the perfect revolution that would have all the best of the democratic system and the radical upheaval of the remaking of the economy, basically using fairly radical socialist principles. I arrived when it was starting to go downhill. The most optimistic times were the first 2 years. The economy was booming, and there was pretty much a live-and-let-live consensus by large sectors of the electorate, certainly the Christian Democrats and all of the left. The right wing, of course, was implacably against him, and of course, there was already plans for subversion going on, but by the time I got there, there was a very large protest movement starting, and by the end of the summer, July, August, there were a lot of protests in the streets. There was some violence, but it was not people being killed. It was right-wing gangs attacking left-wing demonstrations. It was a nasty situation toward the end. People were thinking, is the coup coming? Is the military going to go over with the right and overthrow Allende? And there was a lot of divided opinion about that. When the top general, General Carlos Prats, resigned in August, that was the time that most people said, okay, the military no longer has the constitutionalist commander-in-chief, and this is really dangerous. What people were expecting was that Allende was going to pull the rabbit out of the hat again politically, which he had done many times before, and come up with some kind of a way out of the incredible economic crisis that the country was in, the incredible political crisis. And then on September 11th, I woke up, was going off to work, and was told that there were troops in the streets, and it was happening.
At the time when you were there, you probably did not have a sense that there was U.S. involvement in bringing about the coup.
Well, no, I had been accused of being a CIA agent enough. There was a lot of consciousness that the U.S. had been intervening in Chile. There were revelations that had been made about the ITT papers, the International Telegram Company papers had been revealed that showed that there was subversive action supported by the United States through that company. And so people were denouncing the CIA intervention. There was a lot of paranoia about it. And just being an American, you could be accused of being somebody who was working against the government. So, yes, we immediately thought that the CIA was involved in this, and we didn't have any proof.
Peter Kornbluh, you have read the declassified documents that were here in the U.S. to actually write the history about its involvement. Now, looking back at it, How would you say, and why would you say, the U.S. decided to support the coup?
Well, it wasn't that the United States decided to support the coup. It's that the United States decided there should be a coup even before Salvador Allende put his feet in the presidential office of Chile. He was elected, but long before, you know, weeks before he was actually inaugurated as president, Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon decided this was bad for U.S. interests. It took years to get the documents declassified on what Kissinger's rationale really was, but a lot of the focus was on the fact, as John said, that Salvador Allende was democratically elected, and he was successful in redistributing wealth peacefully, in nationalizing U.S. corporate mining interests in Chile peacefully. His model was going to be one that was going to be emulated around the world, and as Kissinger wrote to Richard Nixon in a top-secret kind of options paper in early November of 1970, just the day after Allende was inaugurated, there would be a imitative phenomena that could change the world balance of power and affect U.S. interests dramatically. Because he told Nixon, Allende has legitimacy, and we can't take that legitimacy away. The only thing we can do, essentially, is make sure that he fails so that his model is not one that other countries in the world, particularly countries in Europe like Italy, decide to follow. So the United States government, through the CIA, was trying to promote a coup even before Allende stepped into office and did anything as president of Chile. And that effort continued for the 3 years that Allende was president, Allende's 1,000 days, CIA covert operations, kind of a quiet effort to cut off economic credits, multilateral credits as well to Chile, make the economy scream was Richard Nixon's famous instructions to the CIA.
In your book, you had pointed out one particular person that was having these conversations who was a media mogul, Augustin Edwards. What was his role?
Augustin Edwards was the richest man in Chile. He owned the leading newspaper, El Mercurio, and we have the documents on this issue that are very detailed. He became the leading collaborator with the CIA and the Chilean military to promote a coup and then to make sure that the Chilean military regime consolidated. The CIA, with the authorization of Richard Nixon, the president, funneled more than $2 million into El Mercurio to keep it going, keep it afloat. Augustin Edwards came to Washington, met with the CIA director, Richard Helms, at a downtown hotel. We've just recently recovered the memorandum of conversation of their meeting and discussed the issue of promoting a coup. And then CIA documents show that Edwards' kind of media empire was coordinating with the military and the protesters in the street to create a climate of uncertainty and instability as Chile's 9/11 grew nearer. One of the most dramatic documents that was declassified more than 14 years now in my book, The Pinochet File, is a CIA document after the coup in which they say that their propaganda effort to support Augustin Edwards was fundamental, critical to setting the stage for the coup of September 11, 1973.
John Dinges, did you have personal experiences while you were there during the coup and after the coup that you could share?
Certainly. I was an American expat. I was a freelance. I was really a nobody as far as journalism was concerned at that point. And the day of the coup, got together with some friends that I was living with, Chileans and foreigners. We took off on foot. There were no buses running, to go up toward Vicuña Mackenna area, which was called the Industrial Belt. And that's where the workers' organizations were strongest. And if there was going to be resistance, if this thing was going to be pushed back, it would happen out there. Of course, we were also looking to see whether there was a division in the military, which, of course, did not happen. And so thinking that the last resort was the workers' organizations who had been reported to be cashing arms and that military resistance might happen from those factories. It took us, you know, 45 minutes or an hour to walk out to this area. We got there and there were buses full of soldiers with armbands showing that they were the coup soldiers driving, you know, back and forth. They weren't getting out yet in that area, but they were. It was a tremendous show of force. And people that we talked to said, basically, forget about it. People are going home. They're leaving the factories. And people were saying, no, this is not going to happen. save yourself, protect yourself. There was resistance in several factories, and there was a lot of killing, and there was at least one low-income area, La Legua, where there was a military resistance against the coup. But other than that, there was very, very little. That said, during the weeks and months after the coup, there were gunshots every night. There was a curfew, and after the curfew started, you could start hearing gunshots around the city. Of course, now we know that many people were being killed during that period. And in fact, my most recent investigation for an investigative organization that I started in Chile, Archivos Chile, documented the day-to-day killings in the streets and the bodies that were delivered to the morgue and in trucks and things like that. It was a horrendous, horrifyingly frightening situation. A lot of that shooting, I think, was to inculcate terror in people. They were killing people, no doubt about it. They killed probably up to 2,000 people in the first 2 or 3 months. But a lot of it was to give people the idea that any sign of resistance would be met with death. And in fact, there was almost no resistance. People were petrified.
And they still killed over 3,000 people and disappeared.
Over the period of the first of the military government, the 3,000, about 1,000 of those were people who were disappeared. In that early period, the mass violence, the mass killings occurred, which was the majority of the killings, and that was in the first months. After that, instead of killing people and leaving their bodies around or taking them to the morgue, they disappeared the bodies. So people were captured by the secret police, taken to torture centers, secret detention centers, tortured, and then a number of those people, probably 10 to 20% of the people who were captured in that way, were then executed and their bodies were buried secretly or dumped into the ocean. That was the phenomenon of disappearances. Another terror tactic. People would just disappear. A good friend of my wife's who I had met, we were with them playing the guitar. And a week later they said, Alejandro is gone. Well, where is he? Well, he didn't come home. And weeks went by, no sign. Rumors came that he had been arrested. Maybe he was going to show up. Eventually, I actually, in my research for my books, came across a lot of information just on him because he was reported inside one of these detention centers and then at some point was taken off and killed, and his body was found about 10 years later. That's just one case of those 1,000 people that were disappeared. It was not the most people killed in Latin America by military governments, but it is the trademark of repression and the use of terror by the state in Latin America. And Pinochet achieved the reputation as the leader of this terrible wave of military governments that started after the Chilean coup, so that almost all of Latin America within a few years was under military rule.
Both of you have written about Operation Condor. Peter Kornbluh, you have a chapter on it in your book, The Pinochet File. And John Dinges, you wrote a whole book about it. Peter Kornbluh, why don't you tell us a bit about what exactly Operation Condor was?
John was talking about systematic violence and its evolution in Chile with mass killings in the first 5 or 6 weeks after the coup, and then the creation of a secret police force, which then undertook very systematic and selective seizures, kidnappings, interrogations, torture, and disappearances. But there came a time when the Chilean secret police decided that some of their key enemies of the state, and not just militants, but also ex-generals who had served alongside Pinochet before the coup, and civilian centrists who were now in exile in Europe, and other members of the Allende government that were even living in Washington, D.C., were their enemies, had to be hunted down and killed. Other militant groups in the region that were trying to unite against all of the Southern Cone military regimes. And so the Chilean secret police, known as DINA and its chieftain, Manuel Contreras, came up with an idea of coordinating basically a rendition, interrogation, and assassination program that was called Operation Condor. It was named at the first meeting of the heads of the Southern Cone secret police agencies for the national bird of Chile, Condor, and referred to as Plan Condor. basically was a coordinated cross-border multinational secret police operation targeting militants and civilians in the region and as far away as Europe and the United States for kidnapping, interrogation, torture, and assassination. It came right to the capital city of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., on September 21st, 1976, when former Chilean ambassador Orlando Letelier and a young colleague, Ronnie Carpen Moffat, were assassinated by a car bomb. And John and Saul Landau wrote an incredible book about that very case.
John Dinges?
Well, Operation Condor was the effort to kill the elite. They had basically controlled things inside the countries, and going internationally was intended to take the anti-Marxist fight worldwide. It started, it had three phases, first to track down the militants. And as Peter said, we're not just talking about left-wing revolutionaries. That was the pretext for the operation. There was an organization called the Junta Coordinadora, the Revolucionaria, the Revolutionary Coordinating Junta, which was the alliance of four left-wing groups, including the Tupamaros from Uruguay and the MIR from Chile. And they were the primary target in Operation Condor, essentially liquidated all of their operations. They had arms factories. They were a very powerful military force, left-wing military force, completely obliterated by Operation Condor. But the secondary target, and probably, I think Peter would agree, the major purpose of Condor was to go worldwide to eliminate the democratic, highly popular opposition leaders, such as Orlando Letelier, who had tremendous access in Washington, D.C. as an opposition figure discrediting the Pinochet government. Another target was human rights organizations, who were being incredibly effective in denouncing the crimes of these military governments. So the documents that I have, of course, the U.S. documents, but I also have collections of documents from Paraguay, documents from Argentina, military documents, investigations that were done in Europe, in which they interrogated many of the participants in Operation Condor, Italian terrorists, Cuban terrorists, anti-Castro Cuban terrorists, an incredible array of no-goodniks around the world whose one goal that Pinochet was fomenting was to eliminate Marxist leaders wherever they could be found, or people who were friends of Marxists. The idea of the fellow travelers were as much an enemy as the Marxists. They actually called this, in one document, one of the Uruguayan leaders called this struggle World War III. They thought that they were in a worldwide struggle to eliminate Marxism and that the United States was not doing a good enough job in fighting back against the Marxist scourge, and that they had to take it upon themselves to go internationally to do this. Luckily, it was nipped in the bud after the Letelier assassination in Washington. The profile was raised so high, and I think to their great surprise, the United States did not go along with this, and the FBI investigated very, very strongly, solved the assassination. Actually, the FBI was the one that made public the existence of Operation Condor and its role in the Letelier assassination. As a result, the Operation Condor really backfired on the military governments because it raised their profile internationally, and these international operations began to be investigated not just by the FBI but other governments. And, you know, I think that was one of the important factors in leading to the ultimate discrediting and defeat of the military governments. Of course, it took many, many years.
It took quite a while for Chile to return to some form of democracy, and they have been trying to pursue justice. And I think, Peter, you've written in your article that something like 70 of Pinochet's military men are in jail. Something like 800 are either under investigation or indicted. How have they rebuilt, and how are they doing on the human rights enforcement aspect?
Many years after the dictatorship has ended, and inevitably the issues of the past have come up again and again and again. So it's a country that is confronting its past through memory and history, but it's also through a debate over its politics. And quite a number of the right-wingers who and pro-Pinochet people who were very much involved in facilitating the dictatorship have now found it expedient to come out for the first time and apologize for their misconduct. The Association of Judges issued a statement apologizing for not supporting the habeas corpus petitions that the victims' families brought to them day after day after day during the 17-year regime. And the right-wing political figures are starting to abandon Pinochet's ship in droves as well. So it's an amazing time in Chile after all these years.
John Dinges.
The Concertacion was the government which brought together the coalition that had broken apart at the time of the Allende government. The left-wing parties, the Socialist Party, which is Bachelet's party, and the Christian Democrats governed for 20 years. And then, in what really was a good sign of a successful democracy, the right-wing parties elected the president. And I think we're now into the third generation of Chileans who are dealing with their past. Younger people, like the famous student leader, Camila Vallejos, who are coming to the fore and are grappling with the past, not with direct memories of it themselves, but stories that they heard from their parents. Many of them, their parents and grandparents, were victims of the military, or, in the case of the right wing, they grew up with the ideology of that the Allende government was the epitome of evil. And, of course, on the left, growing up with the ideology that Pinochet was the epitome of evil. So this is a country that is still grappling with its memory, with its collective sense of itself, and it's not yet a unified country. This is the story, that the wounds are healing as the country works through this, sometimes with very rough edges. But now you're seeing a new generation of people raising new issues, certainly connected to the social issues of the past, but the student movement, the university, free education movement is incredibly important. It's populist, and it is a movement that is against both the Concertación center and leftist parties and, of course, against the right. So we're really entering into a new period in Chilean politics that's bringing Chile, in a sense, into the realm of the populist movements that we've been seeing in recent years in Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia. Totally different kind of politics, progressive, to be sure, but not ideological, not Marxist. And I think there's a lot of nervousness among the established political people, certainly on the right, but of course also on the left, that the grassroots politics is getting away from them. And they see what's happening in the other countries, in Venezuela and Ecuador particularly, where parties have basically been discredited. The press has been under control. And they're saying, you know, what can we do to bring in the new political forces, the new progressive political forces, so that we continue to represent them and they see us as representing them. It's a very interesting time in Chile.
Thank you so much for being with us, Peter Kornbluh and John Dinges.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Maria, for having us.
When we come back, what exactly is just war theory and can it be applied to modern warfare? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Earlier this week, President Obama articulated his plan to destroy the group that calls itself ISIS, invoking the long-held philosophy, just war theory. But, he added, we need a new conception of the old philosophy. What exactly is just war theory, and can it be applied here? Three experts join us. Jeff McMahon is a professor of philosophy at Rutgers University. He is the author of Killing in War, The Ethics of Killing, Problems at the Margins of Life, and Ethics in Humanity. Heather Roth Perkins is a professor of international studies at the University of Denver. She is the author of Global Justice, Kant, and the Responsibility to Protect, a Provisional Duty. Tom Gregory is a lecturer of political studies at the University of Auckland, and he's the author of Drones, Mapping the Legal Debate. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. I want to start with just war theory itself. Jeff McMahon, I thought, given your op-ed piece in the New York Times, you should start by giving us the background and how you see it fitting today.
I think of just war theory not as a single theory, but as a tradition of thought about the ethics of war that has in the past been informed by theological speculation, but has over the past 100 years or so become increasingly secular in its content. And there's a lot of disagreement among people who write about the ethics of war as to the content of what we all call just war theory. So it's not as if there's some one theory or doctrine that we all have and use and deploy to evaluate particular war goals and their application were clear and uncontentious. That's not the case. Though there's probably more agreement in this area than in a lot of areas of ethics, in that almost everybody agrees that there are certain principles that are really important, principles of necessity, proportionality, the justice of the cause, and so on. There's wide agreement about the need for principles of that sort. There's a lot of disagreement about how these principles are to be understood.
These concepts, necessity, proportionality, what exactly do they mean? And can you apply them to today's conflicts?
I would say that most just war theorists over the past few hundred years and contemporary just war theorists agree that there are a number of principles that are important for assessing the permissibility of going to war. These include traditionally a requirement of just cause, which has traditionally just been interpreted to mean that there must be some kind of aim that is itself justifiable or good. I think a lot more interpretive work needs to be done about that to explain why certain causes or aims are just rather than just good. The requirement of proportionality is the requirement that the war should not be expected to cause harm that's excessive in relation to the importance of the aims to be achieved and that could be expected to be achieved. And this requirement, of course, takes into account probabilities, in my view. The requirement of necessity is different in that it requires that there be no other less destructive, less harmful means of achieving just aims. These are very oversimplified descriptions of these requirements, I should say. You can take the study of these requirements about as deep as you want when you start taking account of numbers of people, different types of harms and benefits, probabilities and risks, and people who are liable to be harmed, people who are not liable or innocent in the relevant sense. You know, harms to different people may have different weights or may count differently because of what they have done, whether they're in the right, whether they're in the wrong, and so on. Then there is a set of principles that are meant to govern the actual conduct of war rather than just the resort to war. And traditionally, it has been thought that the principles governing the resort to war and the principles governing conduct in war were entirely distinct, so that the permissibility of conduct in war was separate from and independent of the aims of the war, so that people could be fighting in a permissible way even if they didn't have aims that were justifiable. That traditional view has been challenged in recent years by a number of contemporary just war theorists, and I think it's probably safe to say that that really very important traditional view that dominated just war theory for a few hundred years at least is now no longer the dominant view among contemporary thinkers about just war, though of course it is still defended by many.
We've got a situation where Syria is quite a mess. President Obama has just declared that he's going to wipe out this group called ISIS. Can we apply just war theory to the current circumstances? Heather Ross, what would you say?
Then of course you can, and in fact you should. I think that President Obama's aims need to be justified. We need to make a proportionality calculation. As Jeff explained, proportionality calculations are forward-looking. We can look quite far into the future, but all of the goods that would result need to be related to that just cause in a pretty direct way, I think, and all of the harms have to be balanced against that. So when President Obama claims things like we're going to wipe out ISIS, we need to understand what wiping out means. We also need to understand the long-term foreseeable harms regionally, as well as for the United States, as well as for the global system. And then we need to balance those against what we mean by going to war or limited war and these types of things. So I think those types of calculations or at least estimations need to be made, as well as a justification for going. And if this is self-defense, if that's the just aim, if it's defense of others, those types of claims, as well as the probability of success, right? If you make a very large claim that you're going to wipe out ISIS, you need to have, I think, a pretty good estimation that you can do that. So I think the jus ad bellum principles that Jeff demarcated at the beginning are completely applicable to this conflict. And in fact, they should be at the forefront of the discussion.
Tom Gregory.
Well, I'm interested in this question, I guess, from a slightly different perspective. And that's what I see as the kind of disconnect between what people expect just war theory to do and what it ends up doing in practice. I think a lot of people view just war theory as a kind of external force that can act on conflict from the outside. It can provide objective criteria where we can assess whether particular acts of violence are just or unjust, whether the war itself is just or unjust. But there's this notion that it's a kind of external force that can limit, drain the violence that's enacted on battlefield. It's becoming increasingly clear, and a number of kind of critical scholars have started to point to this, that actually just war theory may play a part in enabling the very violence that it's supposed to restrain or limit, that militaries are becoming very adept at appropriating these principles and using them as a way of legitimizing, of authorizing, of normalizing the violence that they're unleashing, and giving conflict a kind of moral certainty that perhaps it would otherwise not deserve. I don't think it deserves. And it maybe ends up drawing attention away from the more kind of horrific effects of conflict, that we end up losing sight of what actually happens to the people affected by war.
Jeff McMahon, what would you say to that?
I would say that any theory can be twisted or used and abused. But the point of just war theory is to discover and tell us what the limits of permissible military action are. It's certainly not to function as a tool for people who want to pursue their own ends. Well, I don't think just war theory really has a point or a function. I mean, international law does. That's something that we make. And we make up laws, and we have a purpose when we're appealing to laws. We're trying to control, limit, restrain war through law. I don't see that as what just war theory does. It doesn't have a name. It's really rather a body of truths that we're trying to discover about what is permissible and what's not permissible. And people can use the language, the jargon, the labels, just cause, proportionality, and so forth in ways that distort them for their own purposes. But of course, that's true of any kind of moral theory and its application to any other activity. So people can deploy moral concepts and when they're trying to justify all kinds of wrongful behavior. And this is just a hazard that's common to all moral theories and all moral thinking, that apologists for wrongdoing can deploy the concepts that are there for illicit purposes. But that's not at all surprising. It's certainly not something that I think you can blame just war theory for. What just war theorists are trying to do is really genuinely to understand what it's permissible to do and what it's not permissible to do.
Heather Roth, I remember in one of your papers you said even terrorists think they're acting in a just way. They think they're legitimately acting.
The paper that you're referring to, terrorists appropriate the language of self-defense, which is tied to the question of whether or not self-defense is a just cause, and then what are the conditions for self-defense. The just war tradition that Jeff is referring to, normally the jus ad bellum criteria have to be taken together and in concert, right? So you have to satisfy all of them for a permission to fight. So the piece that you referred to that I wrote was really looking at how terrorists have appropriated the discussion of self-defense as a just cause, more under like the international legal terms, such as like Article 51 and things like this is kind of problematic, right? I think what just war theorists are trying to do and trying to understand is it's not just static. In fact, a lot of contemporary work going on says, look, you can't just make just calculations under jus ad bellum and then it just ends, right? Then you have this just, this permissible way to fight. In fact, presumably you ought to review the aims of your war throughout the conflict and see if those aims are matching up. Work by David Rodin, for example, on what he calls jus terminatio, says, look, you should consistently revise and go through these calculations again and again. Daryl Mollendorf, for example, says, you know, is it just to end a war with jus ex bello? I mean, there's all sorts of types of questions being asked that are about these moral truths, right? When is it okay to continue fighting? When ought we to end? When ought we to go? Who is a permissible target to kill? When is that not okay? And so those are not legal questions per se. Sometimes they overlap with law, but they're distinctly moral questions that I think a good reflective person ought to be asking at the outset of a conflict.
And then perhaps you have to have the law to sort of back it up in some way. Before we look at some of the circumstances that we're dealing with today a little bit more closely, I wanted to take a look historically. Jeff McMahon, why don't I put it to you first? When you look at the wars of past, could you say there have been just wars?
There have been a number of just wars, of course. They are wars primarily of defense against wrongful aggression, where the defense is necessary and proportionate. An example that a lot of people think is quite obvious would be the Second World War. Now, when we say that the Second World War was a just war, what we might mean there is just simply that the conditions were met for permissible warfare on the Allied side. Doesn't mean that everything that the Allies did was just. It just meant that there was an actual moral justification for war against Nazi Germany and the other Axis powers. And I think that that's true. I think that war was necessary against those adversaries, and it could have been proportionate, and that there was a just cause, so on and so forth. So I think that the conditions for a just war were met in that case. Again, that doesn't mean that everything that the Allied powers did in the course of that war was permissible. I think there was a lot that the Allies did that was impermissible. For example, I think that Britain and the United States engaged in terrorism on unprecedented levels, levels that have not been seen since then by the very worst terrorist groups that the world has. Nothing has happened on the kind of scale of Dresden, Hamburg, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Tokyo. But still, I think that was a just war in the sense that I gave, that the conditions were met for permissible action. Someone with a better understanding of military history than I have could go back through history and list a very, very great many just wars. And it's important to make this qualification. What I mean by just war is war on one side. So if I said earlier World War II was a just war, that was actually a mistake. You can't say that a war that involves both sides fighting is just or unjust. What I should have said is war by the Allied powers was just in those circumstances, and war by Germany, Italy, and Japan was unjust. And that kind of thing is going to be true of a great many wars of the past, where you find that one side had justification and the other did not.
And this is Heather Rock, and a great many wars where both sides are unjust.
That is certainly possible, too.
The point that you bring up about the acts of terrorism brings in the issue of technology, which is something that Heather, you've looked at, and also Tom has looked at, in terms of using these new technologies. Obviously, nuclear war is going to annihilate far more than the combatants. And I know that in just war theory, you're supposed to protect civilians. So with today's weapons, drones, nuclear, chemical, biological warfare, how do you conceive of using them with just war theory? Can you maintain within the parameters of the morality if you're using these technologies? Heather, why don't you start?
My work mostly looks at things like lethal autonomous weapons and cyber warfare. And I think the principles with which I work, the just war tradition with which I work, informs those views quite heavily. So, for example, lethal autonomous weapons, I don't think that if these weapons were ever to result, would ever be just to use. But drones, for example, are in the eye of the beholder. Functionally, they're not much different than any standoff weapon we have. The pilots who fly them use targeting practices used throughout all military, at least the U.S. military, through all branches. So in that sense, the technology itself, I don't think, is really anything new. But in terms of things like chemical weapons, anything that's inherently indiscriminate, the weapon itself inherently indiscriminate, would be immoral on just war and international legal grounds, because you have to be able to discriminate between combatants and non-combatants. So technology is both a good and a bad, and it's really how you use it that will justify when you're allowed to use something and when you're not.
Tom Gregory?
I've been following some of the debates within just war theory about the use of remotely piloted drones and other new technologies, some of the debates about the legalities of these as well. And what struck me about both sides of the debate is that it's a strangely disembodied account of what is a very embodied practice, that we end up with a discussion about the ethics of war that is kind of loses sight of what actually happens to the people targeted by these weapons. We get a very clean, very sanitized, very bloodless narrative about war that I think circumnavigates some of the really important moral and ethical questions that arise from the destruction of the body in war, wounding in war. So there's been some really fascinating work, I think, from people coming from the feminist tradition, people like Adriana Cavero, Hannah Arendt, Primo Levi going a little earlier, about the actual destruction of the body. What happens, what's significant, morally significant about the body as when it's destroyed? We get a sanitized discussion about drones, the kind of surgical strikes, warheads on foreheads. The body's blown to bits. It's blown to smithereens. If you read some of the kind of very harrowing, very disturbing accounts of the aftermath of these attacks, you hear about people's bodies being blown into, literally to heaps of flesh and bone, that people are unable to differentiate between what is animal flesh and what's human flesh. They're unable to even bury the victims because they're unsure about what parts of the body belong to who. And I think there's a moral significance to the destruction of the body, that you're not just killing somebody, you are almost obliterating them as a person. You're destroying their individuality. And I think there's important questions to be asked around that. And I think that maybe the just war framework doesn't necessarily allow us to kind of have those discussions. So I'd want to kind of broaden it out a bit to engage with those kinds of issues.
War has always involved killing and destroying people's bodies. If I'm going to be killed, it doesn't matter a whole lot whether I'm killed by just having a lance struck through my face and through my brain or through my heart, or whether my body is blown into tiny bits. I'm dead either way. And that's the important thing. It seems to me what's really important in war is discriminating between the people who are morally liable to be attacked, that is, the people who have done something that makes them actually legitimate targets of attack, people the targeting of whom is actually going to do some good and can be justified on the basis of the fact that they themselves, the people who are being attacked, are responsible for some grave wrong that can be prevented only by attacking them in this way. And it seems to me that drones are, as Heather said, fundamentally radically different from weapons of mass destruction like nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, in that they are potentially capable of more discriminating targeting than the weapons of war that have characterized the use of force in the 20th century and even earlier than that, in that these are weapons that can hover indefinitely above the target area, continuously surveying and monitoring the area to find out who's there. They can watch the people that they're thinking of trying to attack. And so there may be all kinds of things that are worrying about drones, in particular that they can be used without much risk to those who operate them. And what that means is that they may be more readily resorted to just because they can be used comparatively safely in this way. So they reduce the deterrence of war and the use of weapons. But to the extent that they can be used in a more discriminating way to attack only those people who are morally liable and not those people who are not morally liable, that's an advance, even if the use of the drone does blow the victims to bits. Imagine the only way that I can prevent a murderer from killing a small child is to blow the murderer to bits. Otherwise, he's going to kill the small child. Well, in that case, he's liable to be killed. It's perfectly permissible to blow him to bits.
I think the good way to bridge Jeff's point with Thomas's point is to look at the narrative of justification. To Tom's point, he's talking about a narrative of biopolitics, right? And so the justification and the modes of justification start to turn on something of biopower, right? Like, this is a cancer, we have to cut it out, it's surgical, it's so easy, it's the right thing to do. And so those narratives start to justify in a different way than traditional defensive narratives, right? But defensive on, like, somebody's attacking me at the moment. We're thinking that a cancer is attacking me, but it's this nameless, faceless virus. So on the biopolitics side, I think Tom's right that we have to be very concerned with the biopolitical narrative. But Jeff is also equally right that if you're liable to be killed, it matters very little how you're killed. You've done something wrong to make yourself liable to be killed. And so whether or not you're blown to bits or not, war is nasty. And we should always think about how awful war is, which is one of the limiting reasons why we don't want to go to war, is because we see limbs on the side of the road. We see horrors happen. It's supposed to be the most terrible thing you can do. So you should be thinking about the terrible nature of war and what it's going to do to the human body. And that should stop you from engaging in it too easily.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about just war theory and the ethics and morality of war in a modern setting. There are three more areas I wanted to get to. One of them is about arming the counterinsurgency as a strategy. One deals with language, such as collateral damage, and one deals with occupation. Occupying Iraq for as long as the U.S. did, occupying Afghanistan. Can these fit in with the ideas of having a just war, Jeff McMahon?
Yes. Arming insurgent forces can be permissible, and military occupation of another country can also be permissible, but everything depends on the details. It's difficult right now to know how to fight against both the Assad regime in Syria and the ISIS people who are in control in certain areas in Syria. These are both groups whose aims are really quite terrible. And both of these groups of people have engaged in massive violations of human rights in the region, if I can use that coded terminology, and both will continue to do so unless they're stopped. How to stop them is an entirely different matter. One of the problems is, and this is obvious, is that there are so few reliable, decent, organized forces in the area. This is an area that seems to be controlled by different groups of dreadful warlord types. And it's hard to find anybody that we can support without having to go in ourselves. And that doesn't seem to be a very attractive option to anybody. So whether arming some insurgent forces in Syria is going to be effective, I don't know. But one of the problems, again, I'm not saying anything new, is that if they get defeated, the weapons that we give them go right into the hands of the people that we oppose. Military occupations can, of course, be justified, it seems to me. I think the Allied occupation of Germany after the Second World War was justified, and the American occupation of Japan after the Second World War was clearly justified as well. These were cases in which order and control needed to be imposed, and we needed to ensure that the regimes that had been defeated weren't able to rearm and begin fighting again. And, but whether an occupation of Syria could be just would depend a lot on whether it had any prospect of succeeding in producing a just order there that would be compatible with the desires and values of the people who would be being subject to the occupation. It seems to me highly doubtful.
Tom Gregory?
If I can be a little bit rude and backtrack a little just to the issue of targeted killings, though I take both Jeff and Heather's point, I think it's important to stress that, you know, we're in a situation now where almost 3,500 people have been killed in Pakistan alone by drone strikes, almost 1,000 civilians. And so whilst there may be people who are liable to attack because of their actions, who perhaps deserve to be targeted, the human costs of this conflict are incredibly great. And I do think there is some moral significance for the families of the people targeted that they can't bury their relatives, that civilians killed in these attacks, you know, are effectively denied a death, denied a funeral. So it's a case of kind of broadening terms of the debate in that respect. I guess the general point I'd make, not being a philosopher, I'm more interested in perhaps some of the repercussions that these conflicts have further down the line. Again, I appreciate the points about attempts to kind of develop or devise a more forward-looking just war theory. But there are questions time and time again about possibility of blowback, the fact that often these conflicts have unforeseeable, unintended consequences further down the line that end up causing more harm than good in the long run. And I guess deep down, one of my kind of issues is just war theory kind of brackets off war as a legitimate area of inquiry, that war is already taken as a legitimate form of activity, so long as it meets certain requirements, which may have various levels of restrictiveness. But war itself is legitimate as long as it satisfies these requirements. And being an incredibly unfashionable but still unrepentant pacifist, unhappy about conceding that ground. I want to reopen that question up. And I admit I'm on shaky ground. If you push me too hard, I'm going to struggle to justify my pacifism. But I still want to have war opened up as a legitimate area of concern. I want to kind of think about the consequences of war in ways that perhaps just war theory doesn't necessarily allow us to. A presumption in favour of peace rather than a presumption always in favour of war.
Heather?
I hate to sound like the answers are always there, like there's some crystal ball, but just war theory does have this, right? The principle of proportionality says you have to look to the potentially foreseeable outcomes, right? Proportionality is forward-looking, the probability of success, but principle is forward-looking. You have to weigh the harms and the benefits, and you have to look quite far, at least in my reading of proportionality. You have to read second, third order of the potential effects of your actions and weigh the second, third order bad effects of your actions. And so the case of targeted killing with the drone program that you're referring to, number one, you have to ask questions of whether or not this is a permissible war. Are we allowed to be there? Is the killing we're doing permissible? If it's not, then no matter what you're doing is going to be wrong. If you're already wrong from the get-go, then you're wrong down the line, right? But if you are engaged in a just war and the people that you're killing are clearly in the wrong, then to me, this doesn't necessarily pose as big of a problem, right? If I'm killing, on Jeff's reading, right, if I'm killing those liable to harm, then they've done something to get me there, killing them. And there are some people who argue that, look, targeted killing is actually much more beneficial than just going in with boots on the ground in large military campaigns that will result in more rights violations. So number one, I think just war theory does have the principle of proportionality that kind of, it does look to your concerns about forward unintended consequences and things like this. But also there are questions about the principle of distinction and liability of harm and who's a permissible target and who's not. If you're a pacifist, then everything's wrong from the start and you shouldn't be there. But that's a different set of concerns. If you think that there are justifiable reasons to use lethal force in defense of oneself or in defense of others, then just war theory is attempting to provide those principles. It's not a condoning action all the time, right? It's actually saying it's pretty stringent. You have to meet all of these types of conditions. And even then you can fight that poorly. So I actually will, you know, rally for just war tradition here and say, you know, it is not just saying war is a legitimate activity, no questions asked. It's saying, what is the condition in front of me? And is it, does it meet these very, very strict conditions in order to be permissible in the first place?
It sounds like what Tom is actually saying is that it's almost impossible to have all of the conditions for a just war met because of what they call collateral damage. I hate that phrase because it does sound so clean when it's not clean, but because of all of the consequences, including blowback and such. So perhaps then a question is it possible to move beyond just war into some kind of just peace? Jeff McMahon.
Many of the philosophers who are considered to be just war theorists have actually given a lot of thought to the claims of pacifism. I've written a couple of papers on pacifism. I know many others have as well. Some people who are in the just war tradition and come to all the just war conferences and so on call themselves pacifists. Pacifism can mean lots of different things, but I tend to think that pacifism depends on a certain approach to moral thinking that primarily is focused on something like the purity of the agent. It says that doing harm is much worse than allowing harm to occur. And that's a contentious principle in moral theory. Most of us hold some version of that. I think the pacifist has to hold a quite strong version of that because, as Tom said, in war, lots of innocent people get killed. They get blown to bits as a side effect. Terrorists kill them intentionally and so on. But one of the reasons for going to war usually is to prevent innocent people from being harmed, killed, tortured, and so on. I mean, I think, for example, that there ought to have been a war conducted by somebody or other, Western powers if necessary, in Rwanda in 1994. Why? Because not doing that meant that 800,000 innocent people were slaughtered with machetes in the course of 6 weeks. Now, I think that could have been stopped. That could have prevented by war that would have killed some innocent people. But I think if you say, well, no, war would have been unjustifiable in the case of Rwanda, what you have to say is that it's impermissible for us to kill 10 innocent people as a side effect, even to prevent 800,000 people from being wrongly killed by somebody else. We should let 800,000 people be wrongly killed by others rather than kill 10 or 100 or 1,000 innocent people ourselves. And that, I think, is a mistaken view in moral theory. I do believe there's an asymmetry between doing and allowing, but it's not that strong an asymmetry.
Just want to let Tom respond to that since this is really addressing some of your concerns.
I take Jeff's point and I, you know, will confess that I'm on difficult terrain there. But one of my general concerns is that just war theory enables us to impose a kind of mirage of moral certainty on what is an incredibly uncertain and contingent realm of human activity. My worry is that it may help us go to bed and sleep well at night, but actually it doesn't necessarily make the world more just. It doesn't make violence necessarily less likely to occur or less harmful. And I guess I just want to be the kind of cheerleader for those of us that don't buy into the just war way of thinking, just to have that debate opened up a little bit wider to take into account some of the other moral considerations that don't fall so squarely within the terrain of just war theory.
I'd like to thank the three of you. It's great to have you here. Heather Roth, Jeff McMahon, Tom Gregory, it's been a great pleasure. Jeff McMahon is a professor of philosophy at Rutgers University. He is the author of Killing in War and The Ethics of Killing, Problems at the Margins of Life. Heather Roth Perkins is a professor of international studies at the University of Denver. She is the author of Global Justice, Kant, and the Responsibility to Protect, a Provisional Duty. Tom Gregory is a lecturer of political studies at the University of Auckland, and he's the author of Drones, Mapping the Legal Debate. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, and Kwatemoc Gileman. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @Armudian, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.